The following episode is brought to you by the American Urological Association. This episode is a continuation of the AUA 2023 take-home messages presented live in Chicago.
Next will be take-home messages, BPH LUTS, by Dr. Dean Elterman, Associate Professor, University of Toronto. Dr. Elterman.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to present the take-home messages for BPH LUTS. These are my disclosures. So BPH LUTS is a very exciting area with a lot of growth. You can see here from the number of presentations at this year's AUA, we have courses, we have a men's health focused sessions, three sponsored sessions, and look at the number of podium and poster presentations here. So there's certainly a lot of interest and hot activity within the area of BPH LUTS. I'm going to take us through what I think are some examples of the areas that we are seeing significant growth. These are amongst many of the excellent research that were presented here at this AUA. So let's start first with some novel minimally invasive surgical therapies, or novel MISTs. First are the 12-month outcomes from the Pinnacle study, which was the Optilume drug-coated balloon for BPH. As you can see here, this is a new way of performing balloon dilatation with a proprietary double balloon. What is unique here is that it creates an anterior commissurotomy, and the balloon is covered with paclitaxel, which allows for a very robust opening and the opening to remain as such. In this 12-month data, we see the peak flow rates significantly improving, up to 98% at 30 days, and importantly, it's sustained out to over 113% all the way out through 1 year. Here we go. Additionally, we see some of the first outcomes for some of the new nitinol-based stents. This is the ZenFlow spring system, which is a novel nitinol-based spring which is placed into the prostatic urethra. This is the first study here in North America based at three centers in Canada. We see very similarly to other minimally invasive treatments, about 11-point improvement in IPSS, or 46%. Impressive improvements in quality of life, as well as flow rates that you can see. Notably, of course, no change in sexual function, both erections and ejaculation. And so for men who are interested in preserving functional outcomes, these minimally invasive stents may be the future. This, of course, is another study with the Irish company from Proverum. They have their Pro-V device, and Thomas Lynch presented their first-in-man study, which is primarily a safety-focused study. You can see here the ZenFlow is sort of a sinusoidal type of design placed into the prostatic urethra. As such, they found no issues with migration, no requirements for catheterization or retention, no de novo ejaculatory erectile dysfunction, and importantly, no removals of the device. Secondary endpoints showed improvements in Qmax and IPSS, very similar to some of the other stents that I've demonstrated. Here, I'm going to shift gears from the investigational minimally invasive stents to the more established FDA-approved devices that are currently available. We first look at water vapor thermal therapy, or Rezūm. This was a propensity score match comparison. Essentially, the look here was, would a minimal approach, i.e. one injection of steam per side, result in equal or significant improvements compared to multiple injections of steam per side? And so we saw in this 146 matched cohort, first of all, if you have more than one injection per side, it results in a higher risk of postoperative de novo retention, as well as urinary tract infection. And interestingly, when you look at the IPSS improvements at 3 months and up to 12 months, there really wasn't a difference between whether you did one injection of steam per side or multiple injections. And so I think the takeaway here is that a minimal approach to Rezūm can be both a safe and effective option for treating men. Another was looking at what are the outcomes of Rezūm for prostate volume reduction. This was a study of 132 men with fairly large average size prostates up to 70 cc's. And what we found on average was that you can expect about a 34% prostate volume reduction when it comes to resumed treatment. But what was really unique was we looked at whether prostate volumes above or below 80 would have a significant difference. And in fact, regardless of whether prostate is larger or smaller, for example, you're consistently going to see a 34% volume reduction. And even in prostates bigger than 80 cc's, over 29% of patients will actually have a greater than 50% volume reduction in their prostate. This was a pooled analysis of over 300 patients who had received prostatic urethral lift. They did a logistic regression analysis of five of their pivotal prospective randomized studies looking at successful durability as defined as no further need for surgical reintervention at 1 and 5 years. You can see here that successful durability was found in most men who underwent prostate urethral lift. And on average, an increasing number of implants was needed for a larger prostate volume. And in fact, as you increase the number of implants, it reduces the need for retreatment. And so baseline predictors for 5-year durability included a lower quality of life score, meaning better quality of life, lower baseline IPSS total score, and lower obstructive symptoms. So essentially the takeaway is that if you are able to intervene earlier when symptoms are less severe, you are likely to get a better long-term durable outcome with UroLift. This was another study looking at how well UroLift functions in the urinary retention type of patient. And so there have been real-world studies as well as the PULSAR study, which was specifically designed for men who have urinary retention. And we see 73% in the PULSAR subjects, 80% in a real-world registry, demonstrating catheter-free rates and surgery-free rates up to 12 months following prostatic urethral lift. Moving on to transperineal laser ablation, TPLA. This is a study out of Italy, and I would commend the authors for creating a randomized clinical trial. This was TPLA versus TURP, with the primary endpoint of ejaculatory function, secondary outpoints being more functional BPH outcomes. And what we see here is that looking at MSHQ, the ejaculatory function and bother, it was unchanged with the TPLA. Whereas, of course, we would expect there was a 30% decrease in ejaculatory function score in men undergoing TURP. And so certainly for men who prioritize ejaculatory preservation, something like TPLA may be a very viable option. But of course, looking at the secondary results, we see being a resective technology such as TURP, you're going to see greater improvements in peak flow, IPSS, and quality of life. And so when asked if they were satisfied with their treatment, about 50% of men TPLA were satisfied, where about 80% of men were satisfied with the TURP. Moving on from the investigational myths to the freely available myths, moving on now to surgical resective technology. So these are operating room-based approaches. This was, I think, a very landmark study. This was the Aquablation Water 2 data for the large 80 to 150 milliliter glands. This was the final 5-year results presented by Dr. Bajani. So we see 5-year efficacy results, IPSS improved by 16 points from the baseline of 22 down to 6.8. Flow rates were improved, and you can see these impressive figures demonstrating the improvements in these outcomes. Sexual function preserved, and again, this is very unique for a resective technology where we would typically expect reductions in erectile and ejaculatory function. And importantly, freedom of secondary BPH intervention, the durability is quite good at 96.3% of patients avoiding any secondary intervention. So essentially a 1 to 1.5% annual retreatment rate. We've also looked at Aquablation postoperative bleeding risks. You can see here in the histogram, the majority of Aquablation cases being performed are certainly between 40 to 100 milliliters. And looking at 20,000 cases performed around the world, we see that with the addition of focal bladder neck cautery technique, the rates of transfusion are now 0.14%, very low, in fact, lower than TURP and other sorts of technologies. Same for take back and clot evacuation. And so this seems to be a major advancement in the field of Aquablation and hemostasis. And lastly, moving on to surgical trends and safety in BPH, there are obviously many databases available to look at both the trend in utilization of the various technologies, both in the minimally invasive space and surgical resection, as well as the safety. Here is an example. of one of the many excellent studies looking at national trends in BPH surgical management. TURP remains the dominant surgical modality around the world and certainly in the United States. And interestingly, that number continues to rise. There was another great study looking at Google trends in terms of searches for BPH technologies. And as our population increases, the number of TURPs continues to increase, even with the proliferation of all of these novel, minimally invasive treatments. Last but not least, of course, safety remains an issue that we should always be keeping an eye out for. This is one of many very excellent presentations looking at safety in the MAUDE database. Here they looked at, of course, the reported outcomes to the FDA database from manufacturers, importers, and device users. They looked at a number of the different keywords. The takeaway here, I would say, is that, of course, there are going to be unique adverse events to each of the various modalities. Rezūm will have things such as ejaculatory dysfunction. UroLift may have some concerns around hematoma. But last but not least, you really have to know a little bit about what are the potential adverse events when it comes to counseling our patients. So it's been an excellent AUA. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present these highlights and look forward to seeing you next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Elterman. Our next presentation will be on the take-home messages around imaging. It'll be given by Rich Matulowicz, who's an assistant professor at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York.
Thank you for the opportunity to present today. I'm going to speak about images. So I have no conflicts of interest to report, financial or otherwise, and some grant support here. So overall, there were a number of truly excellent abstracts and presentations this year related to imaging. There were two discrete sessions dedicated to imaging alone, one podium, one poster, with a total of about 36 individual abstracts. And there were a number of excellent presentations and projects across all urologic diseases. One of the main themes this year was the use of radiomics to aid with human-based diagnostic imaging. Radiomics is a method that extracts a large number of features from medical images using data characterization algorithms that focus on pixel-level spatial relationships. And these features have the potential to uncover tumoral patterns and imaging patterns and characteristics that fail to be appreciated by the naked eye, so there's a lot of potential here. And I've selected two abstracts here that were demonstrative of the potential for radiomics to aid in prostate cancer diagnosis, including one down to the histologic level of cribriform architecture. And this approach has promise and may become an important adjunct to human-read imaging, especially in reducing some of the false positives associated with the PI-RADS system. Similarly, artificial intelligence and machine learning has the potential to improve workflow efficiency, including helping radiologists and clinicians with some of the more labor-intensive aspects of imaging interpretation, like segmentation. And the ability to process large data sets using these methods may also improve diagnostics by allowing for things like radiomics, and also by standardizing the approaches and limiting subjectivity, as some of the inter-reader agreement still lacks at the population level. And similarly, I've selected two different abstracts here that show how an algorithm can be applied to the segmentation of a renal mass, which can then be used for artificial intelligence and machine learning processing to assess some of these radiomics. And then the group from Cleveland Clinic here applied an AI algorithm to standardize the assessment of the renal nephrometry score. And they showed here that this reduced the amount of time necessary, and also they were able to show some of these individual domains were more predictive of complications than in the past. So from here, I'd like to highlight five specific abstracts that I thought were most interesting or potentially impactful in the short term. And this was a group from USC, Dr. Kachimani and colleagues. They reported the application of a machine learning framework to designate a PI-RADS score in roughly 250 people with a single PI-RADS lesion that was biopsy confirmed. And they compared the score generated by the algorithm to those designated by the GE radiologist during the patient's routine care. And they found relatively good concordance and discrimination with the algorithm. And I think given the inter-reader variability, having a standardized algorithm like this can help improve across-the-board quality of prostate MRI readings. And moving along to some novel molecular imaging techniques, Dr. Escobar and colleagues at UCSF reported their experience with 10 patients who had a gallium FAP PET imaging. FAP is fibroblast activating protein. It's found on the cells of a number of different malignancies, including GI malignancies and urothelial carcinoma. So this was a very early experience with this, but I think something that is coming down the pipeline. And what they found was 100% concordance with disease status. That was the presence of cancer or no cancer. And the abstract specifically highlighted the cases where the imaging findings on the FAP PET imaging significantly changed management. One of which here is highlighted was a young man with seemingly BCG refractory disease and potentially early nodal metastases that had positive conventional and FDG PET imaging, which then had a negative FAP scan and then had subsequent biopsy of that node, which was negative. So this clearly changed management of this patient. Similarly, Dr. Shuk, on behalf of an international collaboration of colleagues, presented the results from the phase 3 Zircon study at the late-breaking abstract session. They used a radio-labeled monoclonal antibody, garetuximab, which targets carbonic anhydrase 9, which is highly expressed in clear cell RCC. And they showed that using PET imaging with this radio tracer was able to discriminate clear cell RCC versus non. And interestingly, of the 11 PET positive patients who were clear cell RCC negative on central histopathology, 9 had a papillary RCC, 1 had a sarcoma, and there was a lone patient with an oncocytoma. So this may be helpful for predicting actionable pathology even more so than clear cell RCC. Dr. McCullough and colleagues from Northwell as well as in Florida presented their experience with 15 patients who had laser speckle contrast imaging used at the time of RALP. LSCI is something that displays the tissue blood flow by a coherent laser light scatter from red blood cells, so this does not require any intravenous dye. And as you can hopefully see from the photos here, compared to the traditional laparoscopy, you can nicely see the additional hallmarks of the neurovascular bundles to hopefully aid in preservation. And assessing the true improvement in erectile function and seeing how this is able to be generalized and translated is certainly the next step with this work. But I believe some of this augmented reality during minimally invasive surgery may be very soon down the pipeline here. And Dr. Cicion from Rome, Italy, presented some very interesting work looking at radiographic findings during multiparametric MRI that were slightly different from our normal patient-reported outcomes here, looking at a different detrusor wall thickness, as well as intravesical prostatic protrusion, as well as prostatic shape. And they found significant correlation with lower urinary tract symptoms and Qmax on patients who were undergoing urodynamics. So I think this is something that can potentially be used in the benign urologic world as well to help as a biomarker for both the diagnosis and treatment of bladder outlet obstruction. So in conclusion, there are a number of novel radio tracers and radiographic approaches that I think are going to help with the diagnosis and staging of urologic disease. And I think very importantly, future directions for a lot of this work, as we're almost certainly going to see a number of abstract sessions in the future, but studying the dissemination and implementation of these new techniques and technologies into the clinic, certainly from an equitable care perspective and also from an access to care perspective, will be very important. And understanding how a lot of these, especially these new diagnostics, are going to influence stage migration, treatment appropriateness, and prognosis for our patients moving forward, all remain to be seen. But very exciting times. Thank you again to the organizers for an excellent meeting and session.
Thank you. Next will be take-home messages, robotic surgery. Dr. Andrew Hung, assistant professor at USC. Dr. Hung.
Good afternoon. These are my disclosures. So at AUA 2023, there were 123 abstracts and videos that were presented across 33 podium and poster sessions, 11 video sessions, 1 plenary, and 6 satellite sessions. Broadly, many of these abstracts or presentations were covering in the areas of single port surgery, novel robotic systems, as well as new technologies to enhance robotic surgery. So first, about single port surgery, the da Vinci SP surgical system has been available since 2018, and over the years it has steadily risen in not only the units that have been installed but also the number of procedures that have been performed. Excitingly, there have been a group of 9 institutions, and perhaps it will continue to grow, of researchers that have created this consortium to not only learn from each other, but also to pool their data and analyze them and report these initial findings from early adopters. And here are some of the abstracts that were presented through this consortium. First, a total of 405 cases looking at single port versus multi-port robotic simple prostatectomy. And what they found was that single port simple prostatectomy actually showed shorter length of stay, less use of opioids, shorter Foley catheter duration, and less lower emission rate. A second study from this collaborative, the SPARC collaborative, found that for a single port radical prostatectomy, looking at 1,000 cases, they found that the transvesical approach was associated with a faster time to urinary continence recovery. And finally, another project from the SPARC collaborative looking at both transperineal as well as retroperineal partial nephrectomy, they found that not only was it feasible, but that it was safe to complete. Outside of this collaborative, there were other groups. So single port surgery allowed for us to look beyond the traditional multi-port transperineal access to the pelvis, where we not only popularize extra peritoneal approach, but also a transvesical approach. And as these abstracts and others have looked at, they're not only technically feasible, but they've actually showed for lower pain scores as well as same day discharges. Now, beyond this collaborative, there have been others that have looked into other procedures such as renal autotransplantation, as well as reconstructive procedures such as pyeloplasty. So moving into the realm of novel robotic systems, there have been many that have entered the international healthcare system, and there are several that have now produced some initial clinical results. One is the Korean robot, the Revel I, the Japanese Hintori system, the Chinese Kanduo, and the Medtronic's Hugo, which has now been approved in a number of countries, including Europe. This is Dr. Motri doing the first in-human robotic prostatectomy using the Medtronic Hugo. As you saw from that prior slide, it is a open console design and also features these 4 independent robotic arms, allowing for a modular design and increased flexibility in terms of how instruments are docked. This is from Dr. Motri's group, looking at their initial results of the first 100 radical prostatectomies. And as you see here, that the mean console time was 150 minutes. A catheter was removed in 2 days, hospital length of 3 days, and their positive surgical margin was reported at 9%. Of these 100 cases, the average day to urinary continence day, the 90-day urinary continence rate was about 80%. And this is Dr. Motri in action using the Hugo system, starting the nerve spare operation. Trying to get to the next slide, there you go. So the Kanduo robot from China, there was an abstract that looked at the first 100 consecutive cases, and as you see here, from a variety of different procedures, and they also reported not only the technical feasibility of these cases, but also the initial safety profile of these cases. Similar to the Hugo, it also features an open console design that has 2 screens, one with the endoscopic view, and second, that also allows for fluorescence imaging to be viewed. And similar to many of the emerging systems or ones that have already come into practice, they also feature, this particular system also features integrated virtual reality simulation. The Mantra robot from India also reported its first initial findings across many different procedures, as you see here. And amongst the safety ratings, they also looked at the mean hospital stays, looking to see that they appear to be comparable to those done with the Da Vinci system. Now, outside the abdominal or pelvic robotic environment, there's also been tremendous innovation in how endoscopic surgery has been performed. previously done through a rigid endoscope for cystoscopy and so forth. Here you see that with the innovation of concentric tube manipulators, this has allowed for the miniaturization of robotic instruments down to 1 millimeter. And here you see that contrast between that 1 millimeter instrument and a standard da Vinci tool. And on the left here, you see what a TURBT has looked like for decades in our time for the resection of bladder tumors. And on the right here, you see the Virtuoso system in simulated tissue, but you see the ability for retraction as well as expedited resection of a tumor. This is the same system, but from an external view and also internal view. This will be undergoing human testing very shortly. ...2023 was also an exciting year for PCNLs with the advent of robotic PCNLs, the very first few cases of robotic PCNL. This was done as a team effort between Jamie Lemon at University of California, Irvine, as well as Mihir Desai at the University of Southern California. This is the team that made it happen. And as you see here, it is a robotic, on your left here, you see a robotic system. It's a three-armed system that's being deployed and docked to a patient. And to the right, you see what appears to be Dr. Lemon doing or playing video games in the operating room. But in fact, this is the second human case where he is blasting away at a stone utilizing this Monarch system. So finally, in the realm of new technologies meant to enhance or assist robotic surgery, I'm going to cover two areas. One is augmented reality, and the other is a surgical AI. So this is from Dr. Papuglia's group in Italy, looking at utilizing augmented reality during a caval thrombectomy for with a robotic radical nephrectomy for RCC. And here, as you see, there's an overlay onto the endoscopic view of where the caval thrombus actually is in relation to the tissue intraoperatively. And they've demonstrated in 5 patients that, you know, this can be utilized in a precise manner to help guide surgical decisions at the time of surgery. And finally, from my own group, this was from just a few weeks ago, we published 3 papers in the Nature Portfolio Family journals. And here we created a surgical AI system meant to automate technical skills assessments for a surgeon. We found that not only can it be accurate, but it could be fair as well as explainable. This is the pathway or the automated pathway through an AI system where you have complex surgical videos at the top, and it gets distilled down to singular, granular decisions on whether or not surgical skill was done well or not for very specific aspects of technical performance. And if we look at this model being designed in a native sense, we found that it actually performed differently for novice users versus very experienced surgeons, that in fact it was more accurate for less experienced surgeons. But there, we explored many ways of mitigating this bias, and in fact, by doing so, we were able to improve the performance. And one of the strategies of being able to minimize this risk or this bias for these models was actually to ask the AI model to follow what a human rater would do. For instance, for suturing, a surgeon does not have to look at thousands of frames of video to determine if needle driving was done well. They only have to look at very select frames. And so in addition to providing a ground truth label to the AI models of whether this was good skill or not good skill, if we ask the human raters to provide the actual video frames of where good performance performed, the AI models can actually learn this and in fact perform better. And as you see from all this that, you know, there's been tremendous innovation that continues to happen in the realm of robotic surgery, and we're really excited to see what is in store in the coming year. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Hung. Our last presentation of the meeting is take-home messages on surgical education. It will be given by Simone Thavasilin, associate professor from Rhode Island Hospital.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to deliver take-home messages on surgical education. I'm thrilled to tackle this time slot and synthesize the amazing work going on in education and urology. So at AUA 23, there were 3 sessions on educational research and over 52 abstracts were presented. The themes around this work of the 52 projects ranged from residency management, technical skills, well-being, scholarship, and simulation. Within these themes, there were a number of sub-themes, including application rates and trends within the urology match, preference signaling, fellowship case logs, virtual interviews and practice readiness, the use of modern tools and mixed AI, virtual and live feedback and technical skills, complications, how we manage them, how we train on and teach finances and handle burnout and parental leave. And then additionally, assessing spin within our literature, ethics, publication rates, clinical scholar indexes, and finally surgical gestures and 3D printed organs. So starting within the theme of residency management, student Dr. Corey worked on this practice readiness, trends in chief resident year training experience across 13 residency programs. Their aim was a multi-institutional analysis of case distribution of over 13 institutions during their chief year, comparing to the rest of their entire residency using ACGME case logs from 2010 to 2022. They categorized 5 index procedures, including general urology, endo, recon, uro-onc, and peds. They found that a third of cases were completed during the chief residency year. Urologic oncology was the highest median percentage of these cases. And across the study period, all categories of cases had a downward trend in the median percentage, with the exception of urologic oncology. The take-home message is that U.S. chief residents complete a third of their surgical case volume during their final year of residency, and 50% of these cases are oncology cases. Dr. Passarelli reported on the virtual urology residency interview process through a survey of applicants to a single institution with a 36 response rate, assessing the factors that are influencing candidates on their rank lists and their perceptions of virtual interviews. They found that the important factors when making rank lists include the participant's assessment of goodness of fit within the program, program location, and resident happiness. The take-home message is that virtual interviews replicate in-person for program fit and for resident happiness, but they do not do so for location. And this could benefit from virtual tours, interactive maps, or day-in-the-life sessions. Dr. Calvo reported on time trend analysis for the Society of Genitourinary Reconstructive Surgeons fellowship case logs. They looked at the growth in training that might reflect a change or evolution in their discipline. They examined the trends of fellowship case logs from 2014 to 22 in terms of urethral recon, male incontinence, male sexual health, general recon, abdominal recon, and female urology case volume. They found that overall urethral recon, male sexual health, genital recon, and abdominal recon is increasing over this time period, but notably that female urology is decreasing. The take-home message is that GERS operative experience is increasing in urethral and genital and abdominal reconstruction, but decreasing in female reconstruction. Dr. Saxton evaluated mixed reality technologies for remote guidance during ultrasound-guided percutaneous access simulation through a prospective randomized comparative trial. They compared randomized 12 residents into two groups, those using smart glasses for transmitting both audio and merged surgical fields and training versus in-person perc access trainings. The MR group had a greater improvement in perc access attempts, time, and score, and after crossover training, only the MR group improved in percutaneous access attempts, time, and score. About 70% of trainees found MR similar to the in-person experience for usefulness and clarity, but only 8% preferred it to in-person training. The take-home message is that despite improved performance and equivalency in terms of delivered with the MR technology, trainees' perception towards remote and MR training remains skeptical. Dr. Algoff reported on the learning curve associated with robotic-assisted transperineal MRI ultrasound fusion prostate biopsy. Their aim was to assess the learning curve of this procedure among chief residents, first years, and experts by measuring the time, the accuracy, the performance via EPA questionnaires, workloads, and complications. They found that probe positioning and the total time to perform the biopsy were the major differences seen. They identified a transition for the workload reduction was seen around 13 cases, and they found similar prostate cancer detection rates and complications. The take-home message is that single-institution technical training of robotic-assisted transperineal fusion biopsy demonstrates a learning curve of 13 procedures, with probe placement and biopsy time being identified as the most difficult skills to obtain. Dr. Klimowicz reported on senior versus junior trainees and factors associated with burnout. They evaluated the 2019 AUA census, comparing PGY 1 through 3s to PGY 4 through 5s, specifically looking at the MasBlock burnout index associated with the issues of burnout, depersonalization, and emotional exhaustion. Looking at the PGY 1 through 3s, they found that 50% of this trainee cohort are reporting symptoms of burnout, compared to 40% of those who are more senior, and 2 times the amount of emotional exhaustion compared to more senior trainees. The take-home message is that junior residents experience higher levels of burnout, and top changes to improve work life were meal plans, on-call quarters, and time for health appointments. Dr. Farouk reported on financial compensation for resident call burden during parental leave through applying a method of actuarial analysis to estimate the financial compensation related to a co-resident's parental leave from call burden workload. They evaluated the 2019 AUA census, which showed a 7% likelihood of residents having a child per year, and modeled a Q4 call with 6 weeks of parental leave. They estimated the cost of one junior and one chief resident parental leave is just over $7,000 per year, depending upon salary, average call burden, and the length of leave. The take-home message is that the estimated annual allocation of resources to fund resident parent leave is around $7,000, which can facilitate programs, program directors, and residents supporting parental leave at the local level. Dr. Orji reported on the development of a clinical scholar index score for measuring academic contributions in urology. They developed an academic index to measure non-clinical contributions of academic urologists for their academic activities. They assigned scoring and identified that the impact of early faculty is primarily through peer-reviewed publications, mid-career faculty had the greatest velocity of scholarship, and senior faculty had the most diverse array of contributions. The take-home message is that quantifying non-clinical academic contributions allows leadership to identify ways to support career development and promote growth instead of stagnation, particularly at that mid-career level. Dr. Wu reported on assessing spin in urology randomized controlled trials with statistically significant, non-significant primary outcomes. They assessed spin or language manipulation of the results of 5 top urology journals from 19 to 21. They evaluated over 3,000 studies, just under 50 trials, and they found spin in 75% of studies, 50% of abstracts, and 50% of main text outcomes. The take-home message is that common spin strategies are obscuring statistical non-significance of that primary outcome, focusing on statistically significant secondary results, and emphasizing trends despite non-significant results. Dr. Lee reported on the development of multi-institutional simulation-based surgical skills bootcamp for junior urology residents. They assessed the viability and efficacy of a multi-institutional skill-based bootcamp for PGY1 interns through the New York programs. They did topics like urethral catheterization, cystoscopy, renal and bladder ultrasound, and robotic simulation. With over 30 trainees and 10 faculty, the vast majority agreed that the course provided high-yield information, fun and engaging content, and that they felt better prepared for residency. The take-home message is that multi-institutional skills-based collaborations and collaborative boot camps are feasible and effective in preparing junior trainees for residency. In summary of these over 52 presentations and 3 educational sessions, we see urologists are active in education, and the take-home message is that the urology community is deeply engaged in training and education. Urologists dedicate themselves to the innovation in teaching and education and the development of the next generation of urologists. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to seeing you at AUA 2024 in San Antonio.